What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. So excited to be here with you tonight. Lovely, lovely weather out where I am right now. And we have a great show for you today. This is, by the way, I think the first time I've ever introed a show and mentioned the weather. So a historic moment. But we have a great show for you today. We will be talking to none other than Oliver Stone, who really requires no intro. But in case you don't know, Oliver Stone is an award-winning director, producer, screenwriter, whose films include Snowden, Savages, Untold History, Platoon, Wall Street, JFK, and the documentary JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass. He's also the author of Chasing the Light, which is a really good memoir that I'm enjoying quite a bit. We're also going to be talking to Jim D. Eugenio, who is a researcher and writer who focuses on the political assassinations of the 1960s, including the killing of JFK. He is the author of several books, including Destiny Betrayed and the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and is the co-author of The Assassinations and co-editor of Probe Magazine. And they're going to be talking about the JFK files and what they would like to see in terms of releasing the files, what they would like to see in terms of an investigation. And as I get into in the introduction of this interview, you'll see that Oliver Stone has a very interesting relationship when it comes to the JFK files, thanks to the amazing film he did in 1991 with Kevin Costner. And that's a great film. It's called JFK. I saw it in the theaters, I think. I must have been really young, and I just rewatched it the other day, and the cast is amazing. There's Sissy Spacek in it, Joe Pesci, Kevin Bacon, Tommy Lee Jones. It seems like every actor, working actor, was in that film. So it's a great film. And after we talk to Oliver and Jim, we're going to be talking to Alex Karakatsanasis. Sorry, my Greek isn't that good. Karakatsanasis, who is a civil rights lawyer and the founder of Civil Rights Corps. He's the author of Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System, and Copaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News. And you're going to learn a lot about crime and the media, and he has a lot of shocking information that I think even lots of leftists don't know. Now, the cool thing is that if you are a Patreon supporter, which of course you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. You will be able to get early access to the full Oliver Stone interview because we're going to show you half an hour, around maybe 40 minutes of the Oliver Stone interview. But if you're Patreon supporters, then later this week, you'll get access to the full Oliver Stone interview. So you'll definitely want to do that. And you'll also get access to an interview I did with Jim DeEugenio about who killed Martin Luther King. And again, that's at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Also, if you're watching, please give this a thumbs up. It's a free way to support the show. If you haven't already subscribed, please hit subscribe and then hit the bell. Another free way to support the show. And I think that's it. I think without any further ado, we are going to play the interview that I did today, just a few hours ago. So it's very fresh, with Oliver Stone and Jim D. Eugenio.
Nice to be back, Katie.
Thank you.
You look great.
Oh, thanks.
You must be happy. You look happy.
I am happy. I have a dog. I have a little dog that I can show you guys. I'll show you guys after.
Well, Jim has a cat.
Oh, you do? I'm allergic, but I like dogs a lot more. Here, I'll show you him. Bucky, come here. Bucky, as in Bucky Pizzarelli. And he's very handsome and has a bow tie. In fact, sometimes he'll often sit on my lap and people don't even know. He'll just sit on my lap during the interview. There's so much to talk about. All these recent revelations. You guys both spoke at Congress, which was really fascinating to watch. We're going to go through the new evidence, the documents that Trump released. But I thought it would be a good idea so that people who haven't followed this story and this case and this assassination that closely could understand. I thought it would be a good idea if you guys could each tell me when you started to suspect that the official story was not true, what the official story is, and what you think happened. And then we'll get into the evidence that supports that.
Whoa, the whole history.
I know. Easy question, right? To start out.
I don't want to go on too long, but basically my perception of the case was molded by Jim Garrison's book, which was given to me in 1989 or 7 or 8. And I read the book. It's fascinating. And it was written by Jim as a mystery almost. It was that well organized because he'd written a book 20 years before. And he was going over the same evidence, basically, in the 80s as he was in the 69 period when he wrote Heritage of Stone. Jim was a very impressive man. And in addition to Jim, I was introduced to Fletcher Prouty, who was in the Pentagon, and he worked with the CIA. He was a what they call the focal point officer, and he provided hardware for the CIA's, all their black ops all over the world. And that was a character that Donald Sutherland played in the movie. So the movie, as you know, went through a possible scenario. I called it a counter myth to the myth. And we did a lot of research, but obviously, we didn't know everything that we've learned since then. What was interesting about the movie is it led to such an outcry that Congress moved reluctantly, I would say, to pass the JFK Records Act in order to once and for all clean up this case. That's what they said. I mean, they would put out all the documentation that they had unless there was a real important reason not to. They appointed an Assassination Records Review Board of five people who were fairly conservative scholars, and they didn't have a lot of money, and they existed, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, they existed till 98. They worked from
94 to 98.
They didn't have a lot of money.
And then ran out of money, right?
They ran out of money, which was, and you know what? They actually were somewhat effective. They had some good people working with them, like Doug Horne and
Jeremy Gunn.
Jeremy Gunn was a very smart fellow. They did some good work. We can fill you in on that. That's what we were dealing with. And it came out and it was totally ignored. It was a blackout on it. Essentially, the reigning newspapers of the time said, there's not much there, or it's a nothing. We don't see anything different. And it's Oswald did it alone, which is not true. And they kept to that story because we couldn't provide anything dramatic, like would breakthrough information. We have to accrue the information. This occurred to me as we were doing it, is that this is a very complex case. It's a cold case. And many people are dead. But at the same time, if you look at all the clues as they assemble themselves, you can put it into a computer and you can figure it out. This is not what it was appears to be. And Oswald, we're saying, it does not even appear to have been on the sixth floor where the shots supposedly occurred. And where are the shots from? What we found out in our investigation was that you have to follow what they call the chain of custody. And the chain of custody on the bullets and on the rifle, that's very important. And on Oswald and on the autopsy, you've got to go through all that stuff again. Remember Mark Lane, who was the first one I heard who contested the case back in 64, 63, 64. Mark Lane, they asked him, "What, Mr. Lane, do you have any new evidence?" And he said, "What's wrong with the old evidence?" And that's really the nub of the case. You have to look at the old evidence and the new evidence. And together, you're going to find a conclusion that is pretty clear that it could not have been Oswald, and it could not have been three shots, as the Warren Commission said. But they never backed away from that. The press, the media supported it, never backed away. And what Jim and I tried to do in 2019, it was?
We started in 2019.
And we brought out a documentary called JFK Revisited, which is a very important document. It's 2 hours. There's a two-hour version. There's a four-hour version. We tried to put the essence of what the Assassination Records Review Board was saying onto film so that people might understand better. It did very well. Documentary's still out there on Amazon, but, you know, it's a documentary as opposed to a feature film, so it doesn't quite get the same attention. But the major media never paid attention. They never paid attention. And that is it's a crime, really, against the American public. They're not doing their job. People like you paid attention. But it comes in dribs and drabs, and you have to be smart. You almost need a computer to keep a modern language computer, one of those big deals, you know, where you can put it all in. But if you can keep the case in, we can bring it down to you for 6 or 7 points. And I think that would give you an idea what we were talking about.
Well, it's not true that we were attacked.
Yeah.
Okay? We were attacked, right?
We were attacked by
Tim Weiner. We were attacked by Max Boot. And we were attacked by James Kirchick. Okay.
Well, if you weren't attacked by Max Boot and James Kirchick, then you wouldn't be doing your job. So mazel tov on that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I told Kirchick, okay, look, you're so confident you're right. Let's have a debate at UCLA. Okay. I'll give you all the money that it earns, even the broadcast rights. Okay. You know what he did? He cut me off from his email. Okay. He didn't even want to talk to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, we are welcome to come on my show and debate Jim if you have the courage to do so.
See, what Oliver said there is this is one of the reasons we made the 2 hour and the 4 hour version, because the MSM completely ignored
the mainstream media.
They ignored all the discoveries of the Assassinations Record Review Board. And there were some very, very, very interesting discoveries that they made in those 4 years, you know. But when we interviewed for the documentary, we interviewed Thunheim and Samoluk. Thunheim was the chairman and Samoluk was the deputy director and the PR guy. And they both told us, look, we must have issued 100 press releases and we got almost no notice at all, no matter what we dug up, you know. And so they finally ran out of time and money, and they couldn't finish their job. And this is where Congressman Luna and Trump have finally now picked up the baton, and hopefully, you know, we'll finally get the last of the JFK document 62 years later.
Right. So we're going to go through the Luna proceedings and what you guys said in Congress. Before we get to the new evidence and the documents released by Trump, can you, for people who haven't seen JFK Revisited, just give some of the highlights of the ARRB evidence that was, as you pointed out, kind of shockingly, but also predictably ignored by the media?
Oliver did a really nice job on the medical side in that film. And we had some very credible people like Doug Horn and Gary Aguilar and Dave Mantic. And one of the things that is so important is that they discovered the House Select Committee on Assassinations printed a deception in their volumes. In volume 7, page 37, you'll see a quote that says, "Unlike the witnesses at Parkland, none of the witnesses in Bethesda saw this blown out back of the skull on JFK. All right. Well, when the review board declassified all the House Select Committee documents, that was false. All right. Just as many people saw this blown out back of the skull at Bethesda as saw it at Parkland. 42 witnesses, 42 eyewitnesses saw this. Now, I probably don't have to tell your audience, that is strongly suggestive of a front wound, because it's exit wounds that leave these big blasted out holes, you know, in the back of his skull. All right. Another thing that Oliver brought out with Doug Horn, and I think this is very explosive. When Horn and Jeremy Gunn interviewed John Stringer, who was the official autopsy photographer, they brought out the pictures of Kennedy's head. okay, which Stringer was supposed to have taken. And so Stringer walks up to the easel. He puts his face like right up to the pictures and he says, "This is Ansco. I didn't use Ansco. I use Kodak Etrichrom." And he says, "You see these numbers here at the bottom? This is a press pack. Okay, I didn't use a press pack. These numbers denote a series. I took separate dual folders." And so at the end of the interview, Jeremy Gunn asks him, "Are you ready to deny you took these photos?" And he says, if that's a press pack and if that's Ansco, I didn't take these pictures. And so then Oliver very adroitly had Whoopi Goldberg then say in the film, "Well, if he didn't take them, then who did take them?" You know, and we segue to the whole series on Knudsen. Okay, Robert Knudsen, whose family said he took. So the question becomes, why? You know, you would think something, not really, you know, between me, you and Oliver, you would think something like that would make a blip in the press. You know, it didn't at all.
It suggests, just to sum it up, that there's false pictures of Kennedy's body out there. That's what the public was shown. So that doesn't look like it was a massive head wound in the back of the head, which means shot from the front. So they buried that. They not only buried it, they distorted that evidence. That's a very important point.
You see, this shows a high level cover up. Okay. You couldn't have a bunch of Cuban exiles or the mafia do something like that. You know, only somebody at an upper level in the government could do something like that. Okay, and then the third thing that we should bring up is Oliver also did a nice job on CE-399. And in the film, you'll see Gary Aguilar says that he saw this report that said Bardwell Odom, an FBI agent, showed the bullet to the first two witnesses at Parkland, Tomlinson and Wright. And Gary says, "Well, how come there's no FBI report, a 302 on that?" And there isn't. There's only a Justice Department cover sheet that says it. So he tracks down Bardwell Odom. And he says, "Did you show CE-399, the magic bullet, to Tomlinson and Wright?" And Odom says, "I never showed that bullet to anybody. and if I would have shown it to Wright, I sure as heck would have remembered it because I knew Wright very well when he worked in the Sheriff's Department." So in other words, here you have the FBI lying about the identification of the magic bullet, you know? So in addition to all the things that Oliver put in his movie, you know, about the wild ride that CE-399 took, there's no, as Henry Lee told us, and he says in the film, there's no chain of custody, okay? And any attorney will tell you, you know, if you don't have a chain of custody, the defense will blow your doors in, you know, at the trial.
There's also the chain of custody on the rifle, too.
Right. Very few people know about that. I'm glad we got that into the film, is that the rifle that the Warren Commission says that Oswald ordered is not the rifle in evidence. Okay, it's the rifle in evidence is a little bit over 4 inches longer. It's over 2 pounds heavier. It has a sling that Brian Edwards, who used to work on a SWAT team in Kansas, said that Oswald could never have attached that sling. It had a screwed on thing that Oswald could not have done. So CE-399 would never pass muster in a courtroom. The rifle, you couldn't present. And Henry Lee actually said this to us, and it's in the film. He says, these kind of things get the evidence thrown out in a court of law. It's called inadmissibility of evidence.
There's also right? The fingerprint story.
Oh, my God. Well, that one, that night, the rifle was shipped to FBI headquarters in Washington. And as Brian says in the film, Sebastian Latona, the number one print expert at the FBI, is told to get prints off the rifle. He does everything. He dusts the rifle. He brings in the photographer. The photographer brings in lights to light the thing up. They're hours, trying to get prints off this rifle. And at the end of the day, I can't get any prints of value off of this rifle. All right. Now, Bob Tannenbaum told me, Jim, do you know how good Sebastian Latona was? Every DA in the country wanted Sebastian Latona at their trial because he had written a pamphlet that every department in the country followed. Okay. If he couldn't get prints off, then miraculously, a few days later, the Dallas police do get prints off it.
Good timing.
It's fascinating. The prints are very vague, right?
Yeah, he couldn't get prints of value off it.
In my movie, I suggested fictionally that someone went to the funeral home and imprinted, took Oswald's hand and put it on the rifle. It's the one explanation for how these vague prints got there. There was also, by the way, Oswald took a nitrate test on that same day and he didn't have any nitrate clues on his cheek. Nothing.
Yeah, that's true too. Yes.
I mean, all
no
these
nitrates on his cheek.
This is basic Sherlock Holmes shit. And they miss it. That's why it's so annoying to me that they say, what's the new thing you got? Well, what's wrong with the old shit?
Right.
That no one ever proved it. And no one ever did the basic detective work that was required. Because why? Because there was such a mess bureaucratically. It's clear that Lyndon Johnson didn't want to go into an investigation for real because he feared it. He feared what would come out. He feared that there'd be a war. That's what he said to the Warren Commission.
Right.
I'm just saying, why? America is very smart. We have crime shows all over the airwaves, everything. We love crimes, but we don't even pay any attention to the most basic. The president of the United States, a pauper, would get more attention for a murder than our own president. It's shocking to me.
You do this film, the 1991 film with Kevin Costner. It has a major impact, right? It has a legislative impact. It leads to the creation of the ARRB. You right. Then, because the media ignores the findings of the ARRB, you make this great documentary, JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass. And now, fast forward to today, you have Donald Trump releasing around 80,000 pages of JFK files. So my next question is, what has been released so far by Trump and what hasn't been released that we know of?
I haven't read it all, Katie. You'd have to ask. You know, this takes time. But Jim, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, okay. There are some interesting things. I mean, nobody can read 77,000 pages, you know, in a brief period of time. But so, for instance, what we found out is, see, the Kennedy assassination really bothered Castro, okay? And on the night of the assassination, he made a speech, okay, saying, you watch, they're going to try and blame this thing on us, all right? And then 4 or 5 days later, he made another speech saying, look, I know about rifles. Why would this guy use a manual bolt action rifle if he was going to be doing this thing? All right. Well, guess what? In 1969, it bothered Castro so much, he ordered a reenactment of the Kennedy assassination. And he said, I want my three best sharpshooters to try and do what Oswald did, okay? And guess what? None of them could do it. And in fact, this is one of the most telling things about this whole case, is that nobody's ever been able to duplicate what Oswald did. The only way CBS did it is that they cheated for their 1967 special. All right, they enlarged a target twice the size of what Kennedy's head would do, and then they covered it up. One other thing that is pretty interesting, I think, is that if you recall, on the day of the assassination, out of James Angleton's office, they said that Oswald had conferred with Valery Kostikov at the Russian embassy in Mexico City, and Kostikov was part of Department 13, which is supposed to be in charge of liquidations in the Western Hemisphere. The CIA in 1971 wrote a memo saying, we don't have any credible evidence that Kostikov was part of Department 13. I thought that was so interesting because Oliver's had some telling comments about Angleton in front of the Luna committee. All right. This appears to be Angleton's his intent to frame Oswald with Kostikov to blame the assassination on the Soviet Union. If that second CIA memo is true, okay, that's very interesting. One last thing. Robert Blakey, who was the head of the House Select Committee, was writing letters to CIA about how do you set up a 201 file and what are the reasons for setting it up. And I want to see Oswald's 201 file. The reason he said this, Katie, is because a very funny thing happened to Oswald's file when it came in, when he left for the Soviet Union. He had a woman named Betsy Wolf working for him on this assignment. She examined all the charters of the CIA. And then when she was done, she did an imaginary graph. Okay. This is what Oswald's file is going to do. Now give me the file. So she gets the file. And guess what? It doesn't do anything like what it's supposed to do. Okay? Instead of going to the Soviet Russia division, it goes to the Office of Security division. Here's the catch there. The Office of Security does not set up 201 files. That's why Oswald did not have a 201 file for 13 months. When Richard Helms was confronted with this, he said, what? Because Oswald didn't have a 201 file? You know? And so finally, she interviews all these people. She brings in a guy named Bob Gambino, who's the head of the Office of Security at the time in 78. He says, look, it doesn't matter how many documents come in. It doesn't matter if they're pre-stamped. If the client has gone to the first gate, which is the Office of Mail Logistics, that is where all the documents will go to. What this means is somebody was rigging Oswald's file at CIA at the time he left for the Soviet Union. Can you imagine that? I mean, nobody even knew who Oswald was at this time. Yet somebody in the CIA is rigging his file. That's what Blakey was so worried about. And the punchline is this. Betsy Wolf's work never got into the HSTA volumes. We didn't know about it till it was declassified by the ARB.
Yeah, the three women story is a side show because it was brought to our attention when we were making the documentary by a wonderfully interesting... Is he still alive?
Barry Ernst. Yes.
Ernst.
I think you're right, Ernst.
Well, I think you should interview him, Katie. It's fascinating. He did a lot of research. All these guys do a lot of research. And Barry followed up the story of Sandra Stiles and Victoria Adams. And Dorothy Garner. These three women, Garner was the older one. She was a supervisor with a position of some responsibility. The other two are younger women. They were all on the fourth floor watching the motorcade go by. They saw the shooting. The moment they saw the shooting, they responded and they made an effort to get down as fast as possible to the front of the building. They ran down four flights of stairs. Two of the women went ahead, and Dorothy Garner came to the edge of the staircase looking down at them running. This was within a minute, maybe less, that these fourth floor.
It was 15 to 20 seconds.
Maybe so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't ever see Oswald. Now, Oswald is up on the sixth floor. Apparently, he's got to get rid of the rifle. He's got to stash it someplace. Who knows what he was supposedly doing? And he runs across a very crowded, stacked boxes floor and gets down the stairs. It can't be done and not be seen by these three women. No evidence of that. Marion Baker, the next thing we know about Oswald, Marion Baker claims to have seen him on the second floor of lunchroom, which was shown in the film that I made. And he was having a Coke and having lunch. Okay. So he's on the second, and then he goes, we know from later that Oswald goes outside and walks away into the streets. So these three women, one of them is allowed to testify. And apparently she said, tell me exactly, Jim, she was interviewed by the
David Bellin. David Bellin on the Warren Commission.
David Bellin, yeah.
She suggested, well, look, why don't you call Sandy? Okay, she was with me the whole time, you know, and Bellin said, we don't need her, we have you. Okay, right. So obviously they didn't want the corroboration. And here's the capper to that story, which Barry told us on camera. The local attorney general's office in the Dallas-Fort Worth area talked to Dorothy Garner, all right? And she said that, yes, Sandy and Victoria went down the stairs, and then I saw Baker and Truly, the building supervisor, come up the stairs after that, all right? She forwarded that information to the Warren Commission, J. Lee Rankin, the chief counsel. It's nowhere in the Warren Commission volumes. So you have 26 volumes, 17,000 pages, and you don't have enough space to put that very important piece of information in it. Barry found that as a result of the ARB. Okay, and that's how we know about it.
Yeah, and the Stiles testimony was changed too.
No, the Adams testimony. Adams. She was the one that was testified before the Warren Commission. And she said later to Barry that there were certain parts that I didn't say that. I said this. Okay. And Sandy Stiles wasn't even interviewed by the Warren Commission at all, period.
I mean, for my taste, I believe three women, ordinary women, I believe what they saw. And I believe they're telling the truth because there's no motivation.
Yeah. What's their ulterior motive?
And yeah. they're the closest of anybody to this killing. They're out the window and they see it on the fourth floor and they run down. Yeah. So it's very very depressing when these things happen. And it's happened so many times, as you saw in the original movie I did. So many people disappear. So many people, Bowers and the railroad signal there.
And by the way, to Oliver's credit, you know, that is in 1991's JFK. He has that happening in his 1991 movie.
And we have Oswald running down the stairs.
Right.
To show how hard it is to do this.
Right.
And get out of the lunchroom in time to see Marion Baker. It doesn't jive. It doesn't jive. These are physical things you can do on film. You know, as early, and the big thing about this latest information is that it's the degree of involvement of Oswald with the intelligence community. That's the massive evidence of some kind of collusion. How does this guy who apparently has no background and is a bum and is a lone nut, how does a lone nut happen to know all these people who he's seen with in New Orleans and in Dallas and in maybe Mexico City? He's seen with agents. Why does Angleton have his name on file from 59 on? It indicates what Richard Schweiker called the fingerprints of intelligence are all over Oswald. And we have never faced up to that because why? Because the CIA is sacred in American political history or something. They're not sacred. They're a bunch of criminals. This is what we're trying to say. And we've been saying it from the beginning. I got scorched by this, scorched for criticizing them as thugs, as basically mafia. And they we know that they cooperated with the mafia. That's not to say all the people in the CIA were bad. No, these are key people in very important leadership posts. They include Richard Helms, includes, I think, Alan Dulles, although he stays clean as much as he can of the whole thing. But he's in charge and he's fired by Kennedy and he's around the case for all these months. He stays in Washington. He goes to every meeting of the Warren Commission. He monitors the Warren Commission, makes sure that they know nothing about Cuba, the Cuba operation, which he knows a lot about. He doesn't open his mouth. He doesn't say that we're trying to kill Castro all this time and we're financing these anti-Castro groups in Miami. We have a gigantic station called
JM Wave.
JM Wave with a... How many people there? 800?
There's hundreds of agents at that JM Wave. Yeah. It's almost 1,000.
Okay. In other words, it's bad intent. It's bad faith.
And you call, I watched an interview of that you did years and years ago, and you compared, of course, having Dulles on the Warren Commission to like asking the fox to investigate the hen house.
He actually said that in front of Congress. Okay.
And that was my interview with Oliver Stone and Jim DiEugenio. I hope you enjoyed it. And again, to access that full interview, we will be releasing it later this week at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. We'll also be releasing later on a clip, a mini interview. I'll just say an interview that I did with Jim about who killed Martin Luther King. So now we are going to start the live interview portion of the show. And if you're just tuning in, please do like this show, give it a thumbs up. Also subscribe if you haven't already, hit subscribe and then press the bell. And we're going to be bringing on Alec Karakatsanis. I'm really sorry, Alec. I can't be the only person who doesn't pronounce it correctly, but I'm going to have you give me a mini Greek lesson when you get on, who is a civil rights lawyer and the founder of Civil Rights Corps. He's the author of Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal and Justice System, and more recently, Copaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News. So welcome, Alec.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, thanks for coming on.
And by the way, I say Karakatsanis, but okay, growing up, everybody said Karaka can't stand you. So I've kind of heard everything.
Terrible. All right. Well, we will not call you that, but I'm glad that that gave you the thick skin that's needed to do the kind of work I'm sure that you do.
That's right.
So this book is great. I don't have it on me because I left it in the city and I'm not at home right now, but I want people to know I do have a physical copy and it's a really good read and it's actually funny. And I have a bunch of questions for you about this book. So I'm going to start off with one that's a little bit basic, but heady. And then we're going to get into some recent news and how your discussion of Copaganda applies to that. And also how people can use your discussion and your framing as a kind of a tool of media literacy when watching the news. So firstly, what is Copaganda? How does it function? And why do you refer to, instead of the criminal justice system, the punishment bureaucracy?
So I think Copaganda is a special kind of propaganda that is focused on really three main things. First, it wants us to narrow our conception of safety and narrow our conception of threat, basically to the things that poor people and people of color, Black people, immigrants, strangers are accused of doing by police. Those are the things that it wants us to constantly focus on, as opposed to a much wider range of harms that actually pose a more significant threat to our health and safety. So for example, Copaganda might have you focus on, you know, a wave of retail theft from stores or individual street crimes by strangers or supposedly by a wave of immigrants, as opposed to wage theft by employers, which is, you know, $50 billion a year. So wage theft alone is about five times all property crime combined, as reported to the FBI, and tax evasion, which is about $1 trillion a year. So that's 60 times like all FBI reported property crime combined. Or, you know, air pollution, for example. So a lot of air pollution is literally a crime. Criminal acts of air pollution kills about 100,000 people a year. So that's like five times the number of homicides. And you just don't see stories every single night on the nightly news or the daily newspaper about all the air pollution violations, all the water pollution violations that are just destroying people's lives, killing children, giving people diseases, chronic illness, et cetera, et cetera. So Copaganda like narrows our conception of threat. You know, you don't see a push alert on your phone every time a police officer illegally like beats somebody up or something like that, right? The crimes of the powerful and the wealthy and the state aren't included in things that we're constantly supposed to be afraid of. The second theme of Copaganda, the second thing that I think it really does, is it wants us, having narrowed our conception of threat, to always be afraid of those things, right? So over the last 25 years, if you look at public polling, people constantly think that crime is rising every single year, even though crime has been going down. We're at historic lows of crime. Almost every single year over that period, crime has gone down. And contrast that with when you ask in those same surveys about crime in your own neighborhood, people are much more accurate. They're much more likely to think crime has not gone up. And so it's mediated through the mass media propaganda. People always think, well, crime must be worse in other places. And then the third function of propaganda, like having narrowed our conception of safety and constantly made us afraid of those narrow range of things, but not of other things, it's constantly peddling to us the totally false and anti-science, anti-evidence notion that the way to protect us from all these fears is more and more and more investment in what I call the punishment bureaucracy. Police, prosecutors, prison, probation, parole, and the multi-billion dollar industries that surround them at every stage. And the solution to every problem in contemporary US propaganda is more money for police. Even police brutality, the idea is more money for police. There's these economists that have actually studied the stock prices of police industry companies, and they go up after incidents of police violence against Black people. The idea is that they all understand that even the police's own violence is going to be spun to say, well, we need more money for better technology and training and things like that. That's the third and I think maybe most important function of propaganda. And to me, a lot of people use the term, you know, criminal justice system, but to me, that's also a term of propaganda. It's not unlike when the United States government changed the name of the Department of War to the Department of Defense. You know, at some point, it became a little unseemly to be telling people, hey, we're going out and making imperial wars to make our country richer. We needed to start framing a lot of what we were doing around the world as defensive. And I think in a similar way, the idea is to somehow frame this massive, profitable machine of injustice as doing something really good, something that we need. That's a relatively recent phenomenon. For much of the American history, this system was not thought of in that way. The police didn't market themselves with these slogans of safety. Everybody understood that police forces were about catching enslaved people who ran away, crushing striking labor, et cetera, et cetera. It's a modern creation that we're trying to create this idea that the thing that this thing does is either intended to be or actually justice and safety.
Right. Well, I think one of the most fascinating things in your book is how much it debunks so much. It debunks so much. But one of the things it debunks is, of course, that crime is at an all-time high or crime is rising right now. And then the other thing it debunks, which you just referred to, is the idea that throwing more money at this punishment bureaucracy will make people safer. And I think that's interesting because, you know, sometimes moral arguments and self-interest arguments don't always line up. I think in this case, we're really lucky because it turns out that investing in things like people, you even show in the book that having like more health coverage, having health care can lower crime. So in those ways, it's actually a great thing for the left to talk about and everyone to talk about, honestly. But can you talk a little bit about the ways that things other than investing in police create safety, especially the things that we wouldn't necessarily predict?
Absolutely. So not only can those things lower crime, they're literally what the studies show most significantly increase our safety and reduce violence and reduce all kinds of interpersonal harm. So expansion of Medicaid is one of the single most effective things you can do to lower crime and reduce violence. Early childhood education, huge positive effects in really robust research and studies. And this is something I talk to a lot of people because I'm a civil rights lawyer. I work inside the legal system. I was a public defender. I know a lot of police, prosecutors, judges, sheriffs. I talk to a lot of people. I really never met anybody. And this is a kind of a dirty secret of the system. I never met anybody in private who thinks that the little policy tweaks that they make, you know, little charging decisions by prosecutors, little tweaks in bail policy, a 5-year sentence versus an 8-year sentence, 10 more cops on the force as opposed to 7 more cops as opposed to 3 fewer cops. None of these people actually think those things are driving long-term crime in this country or long-term interpersonal harm, right? All those people know the truth, which is that only 4% of all police time is spent on what they themselves call violent crime. It's a total myth that's perpetuated in the news media that all these like policies in the criminal system have any connection to crime. You've got like the NYPD chief and the LA sheriff talking about bail reform, increasing crime. That's like climate science denial. The things that actually like relate to the levels of violence in a given society are big things like inequality, poverty, access to housing. I mentioned healthcare and education. Another thing that is a little bit counterintuitive, one of the best things that we can do for reducing violence and crime is lead abatement. So exposure to lead in little kids actually has been shown to increase levels of violence in a society. Lots of things like that we know actually, you know, more public space, more recreational activity for young people, more theater, music, art, poetry, after school programs, streetlights and parks. Like, these are things that, like, the research actually shows reduce violence and harm. And they're exactly the things, like libraries, that are being divested from so that we can put more money into multi-billion dollar police surveillance contracts and military weaponry and overtime.
Yeah, it's interesting because we can get more into defund the police as a slogan and also as a movement. But what is definitely true is that when you change the way funding works, you're actually making society safer. All these things that you can fund instead of police are the ways that you make society safer. And funding the police actually doesn't, as you point out throughout. How does Medicaid expansion, by the way, relate to crime?
Well, there's all kinds of research that shows basically that the more unstable and precarious people are, the more likely they are to lose their jobs, the more likely they are to not get coverage for mental or physical health needs, the more sort of unstable they become. And the more unstable people become, the more they're criminalized. And the more their behavior is targeted by the punishment bureaucracy. So, you know, a lot of these studies don't actually, I want to be really careful about how we study the research. Like, a lot of these studies don't attempt to see the exact mechanism by which Medicaid expansion reduces crime. They just kind of study Medicaid expansion and do sort of rigorous analysis to remove other variables. And they determine that Medicaid expansion through whatever mechanism ends up reducing crime. And that's why it's one of the key themes of the book is there's all these subtle ways that the news media is constantly messing with our brains and making us think that there's a link between police and crime. So for example, there'll be a shooting and like the stock image in the newspaper is like a police car, as opposed to a chart of like government funding of housing or healthcare. Or there will be articles about crime and the perspective and the sourcing and the quotes and the language and the whole framing is all about what are police doing and what are the policies of the prosecutor and when those are literally not the things that are connected to crime. It's this kind of really subtle form of propaganda where it's not like the news is always making a direct claim that you can refute. It's all the little things underneath the news that are assumed but never kind of argued or stated. So they hit our brains, but we're not sometimes primed to challenge stuff that is kind of just assumed and baked into the very premise of what the news is saying.
Right. It's not like an overt lie necessarily. Sometimes it is, but often it's much more insidious in the examples that you show.
Absolutely. And one of the most, I think, fun parts of the book is I sort of explain how scholars of propaganda have long understood that the very best propaganda, the most effective propaganda, particularly against liberals and progressives, is based on true facts. So, you know, if I wanted to convince you that LeBron James or Michael Jordan or Steph Curry were bad basketball players, I could take a video montage of their entire careers and just choose all the missed shots. I could make an entirely true video that was hours long of Steph Curry just missing shots. And you might conclude, hey, this is a pretty bad shooter. But I'd be using true anecdotes. And that's very similar to what the media does with like retail theft or shoplifting. It's picking out anecdotes that are, you know, may be true. It may be that this one video is a video of a shoplifting, but it might falsely convey to us if they do 10, 15, 20 of those every week, that shoplifting is rising and that we should be really afraid of it. And so it uses true facts because propaganda is a little bit less effective, particularly against liberal people and people, you know, in progressive circles, if you can easily demonstrate that the facts they're telling you are not true.
Right. You just easily debunk them and then they lose credibility.
Right.
So you actually quote in your book, you quote French sociologist Jacques Ellul, who says, For a long time, propagandists have recognized that lying must be avoided. It seems that in propaganda, and obviously, just to clarify, there are propagandists who lie. That's a different genre. But for a long time, propagandists have recognized that lying must be avoided. It seems that in propaganda, we must make a radical distinction between a fact on the one hand and intentions or interpretations on the other. The truth that pays off is in the realm of facts. The necessary falsehoods, which also pay off, are the realm of intentions and interpretations. This is a fundamental rule for the propaganda analysis. And this, of course, comes up a lot, as you just pointed out, when we're talking about, you know, liberal, educated, enlightened. I mean, these are the way they were describing themselves, audiences, people who have a lot of contempt for people who watch Fox News because they think that they're propagandized. It turns out are very propagandized themselves. And you actually write in the book that liberals are the most propagandized. Can you explain why that is?
Yeah, it's another thing that Elul discussed in the 1960s in his study of propaganda across different societies from Nazi Germany and China and Russia, and then capitalist United States. One of the core truths across all these societies was kind of like the educated elite are the most susceptible to propaganda in a lot of ways. And there's really three reasons for that. Number one, they consume the most news. They consume the most secondhand, unverifiable information about the world, right? They're the ones constantly plugged in and getting the push alerts from the New York Times on their phone, et cetera, right? So their understanding of the world is less mediated by their individual interactions and things they personally observe, and more mediated by consuming lots of information. And if you're not careful in our society, most of the information sources that are fed to you have certain agendas, right? I mean, really, every information source has an agenda. You just have to pick what agenda you want. Do you want somebody feeding you information whose agenda is to make the world more equal and just and human beings and plant life and animal life can flourish? Or do you want an agenda to make money or to sell weapons contract, you know? So the second reason that liberals and elite intellectuals are more susceptible to propaganda is they literally, he writes, they feel the need to have an opinion about everything. There's this sort of like arrogance where it's like, oh, well, I've got to know about this thing and I've got to know about that thing. I've got to have an opinion. And then the third reason, which I think is really resonates to this day, is they think they're smart enough to be impervious to propaganda. And that level of arrogance makes them particularly susceptible to like not questioning things and to thinking that they can always be impervious to influence. And that's really, really dangerous when you lose that kind of like basic humility and skepticism. And I just want to say there are very effective forms of propaganda for different types of audiences, right? You know, propaganda that's effective on, really elite educated people is different from propaganda that's affected on other people. It's, you know, propaganda targeted at the far right base is different from, so there are different kinds of propaganda. But in general, you either want to be using true facts or facts that the person that you're propagandizing doesn't have any hope of learning are false.
Yeah.
So in a world where the authoritarian control over the information is so extreme, or people are so, like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, propagandized that they have lost their ability to question. So in Orwell's world, you know, a world where everybody is thinking already 2 + 2 = 5, you know, you can do some outright falsehoods because people's ability to tell the difference is really compromised. And in a lot of ways, the capitalist assault and the right-wing assault on like basic journalism, local news gathering, is actually an assault on our ability to get underlying facts. That's one of the reasons you see the Trump administration surgically, and particularly DOGE, surgically targeting all the government agencies that do data and statistics and information gathering. Because if you make it really, really hard for people to get information about the world, then you open up another world of propaganda that's able to be sort of factually lying about stuff, you know? So I think, but in general, and my book is really focused on liberals and progressives and mainstream news, and the most effective propaganda against them tends to be based on like selectively true anecdotes presented for false, misleading purposes.
Right. So in contrast, for example, to like Israeli propaganda or Hasbara, which is just outright lies. I mean, you know, that it's a very different style. They're very bold in their propaganda, the Israeli government and the people who support them.
But I would say that, I mean, I think that's a brilliant point. And also, the New York Times propaganda in the United States focused on Israel yes. is of a different sort.
Right.
It's often based on, I mean, it often is actually repeating the lies of the Israeli government, you know, because there's this sense that like they have so destroyed the world's ability to know the truth about some of the situations that the New York Times, but a lot of the New York Times propaganda geared at liberals is actually based on.
Falls into that other genre, right? That you, yeah, exactly. So like, or stuff like passive voice versus active voice. Why do they focus on this person's crime, this person's death, this person's trauma and not this one's? Yeah. And you see that a lot with when you contrast Ukraine and Gaza, for instance.
It's such an important point that like the concept of what is news. So the New York Times has this slogan, all the news that's fit to print, right? And they have these like headline things on their urgent news thing. It says like everything you need to know. Somebody at the New York Times is literally deciding for you and your brain, of all the millions of things in the world that are happening today, which 10 or 11 or 12 am I going to tell you about and which am I going to ignore? And so just by repeating a bunch of true stories, you know, like by doing a story on every single hostage, right?
Exactly.
They right. can shape how you think as opposed to every single hostage that the Israelis take or every single death in Gaza, or you can apply this logic across, you know, news topics to see how it's very easy to actually manipulate what people think is urgent.
Right. Yeah. The push notifications. I think it was Leila El Arian. I may be wrong, but I think she may have tweeted something about how she never gets push notifications on issues around Gaza, you know, when the victims are Palestinians. So I want to just show one quick image, which debunks the claim that we see in the New York Times, even, which is that crime is, you know, an issue, a really dangerous thing, a really important thing. So you tweet, with all the propaganda, panic and lies about police reported crime over the last few years, it's important to share this chart with people in your life. They'll learn a lot about crime, but more importantly, about the power of mass media manipulation. It shows U.S. crime rates continue to fall and preliminary data indicate that the 2024 crime rate was the lowest since 1961. Now, obviously, you would never know that from the way the media talks. And I think like this isn't just Fox News. I think Fox News is a little bit more heavy-handed when it comes to crime. And also, it's the related theme of immigration, which, of course, they really criminalize. So for them, it's not even a separate issue. Like, I think of it as a separate issue. But for them, it's one and the same. But, you know, people just take for granted that it is a crisis. We have a crisis at the border. We have a crisis when it comes to crime. And so that is a very useful chart. But I also wanted to show, speaking of the New York Times, you had a great thread about the way the New York Times is reporting on what's happening with Bukele and El Salvador and Trump. So let's take a look at this tweet. So you write, thread, this is one of the more remarkable stories I have seen in my time studying state violence and working on law. But it's also an exercise in propaganda, and it's unbelievable how terrible the US media coverage is. One thing in particular is important to see.
The headline is Bukele proposes deal that would free deported Venezuelans. And then the whole article is about this really bizarre turn of events where the president of El Salvador is now offering to exchange all of the deported. And I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to use air quotes for now, because I think it's completely absurd for the New York Times to be calling this a deportation. It's a kidnapping and human trafficking that doesn't follow any settled principles of deportation law or any other law. But he's now offering to trade them for lists of people that the far right is concocting that they want freed in Venezuela. So I think like, just let me take a step back and how these two things you just showed fit together. Not only have we been fed this idea that crime is soaring, and one of the great scandals of our time is that MSNBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, all these kind of mainstream news outlets that are not the New York Post and not Fox News have created a situation where people across this country feel that crime has been rising and that crime is at, you know, historic highs, when in fact it is at historic lows. That is an incredible achievement of propaganda. I just want to pause on that for a second. Related to that, there is an incredible and really, I think, quite devastating connection in public polling and in people's minds. And I'm going to get back. I have a chapter on polling. And by the way, I think most polls are actually not accurate at all, and they completely manipulate people's responses by how they ask the question.
I mean, even what's polled on is political, because you have to have money to do the polls, and yeah.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter that I think will hopefully change the way you think about polling. But the idea is that somehow immigrants commit a lot of crime. Right. When immigrants commit crime at lower rates than U.S. citizens, and none of the major, you know, supposed crime waves in this country are driven by immigration or immigrants. I mean, it's just a total fabricate. It's like climate science denial. And the mainstream news has completely and utterly adopted and accepted this assumption in much of its coverage by what it chooses to cover, the volume that it chooses to cover it at, the words that it uses, you know, a wave of migrants and a surge of migrants and reporting all these individual crimes by migrants, right? The San Francisco Chronicle had this hilarious, I think, you know, it's important to laugh at some of this stuff because it's just so absurd.
And you give great awards to people, yeah.
I give little awards to journalists in the book. I mean, the Chronicle has this absurd line of stories about, like, you know, in global immigrant rings of like burglars and thieves and stuff with no evidence. Like, it's just like one of the, you know, the piece of evidence is like somebody there, like, you know, like somebody who rented a car in one of the cities was like from Chile. I mean, it's like, anyway, so that's not to say that there isn't crime and that like nobody who is not a U.S. citizen never commits a crime or anything like that. But it's the idea that there's these trends and patterns from which we should make these consequential policy decisions. And it leads to this idea that, like, that is, we are socialized in, that we need to do these mass deportations and there's this invasion of the United States by, you know, so all of these concepts are actually coming from the mainstream news too. Right.
So then you have actually the left, and this is an important distinction. I actually want to start doing this as like a game on the show, which is like ignorant or dishonest, like lying or duped, because you do distinguish between people who are in good faith consuming news and really think it's the truth, and then people who are cynically basically misrepresenting it. So you have people on the left who either cynically or ignorantly really think that they have to, they're adopting right-wing framing, but they don't think that they are. So they're like, look, we may not care about the border, but it's just a real issue that we gotta, that we can't win elections unless we go to the right on the border. Or we may not, you know, be that concerned with crime, but we gotta shift right to win the elections.
There are some people like that. And I think there are a lot of more, what I would call more ordinary people who've been brainwashed into thinking that. I don't think there's any evidence to support that. First of all...
Oh, no, me neither. Just to clarify, I was saying that this is what they've internalized based not on anything except the same kind of propaganda that we were talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I show in the book how that's, it's actually totally false when you actually look at elections and what people are running on. And also it creates a world where if you somehow win that election, you're unable to do a lot of the progressive things you want to do.
Of course. Yeah.
And it fundamentally alters the fabric of our social landscape. I think that most of the elite people that I am in circles with, and you know, I'm a civil rights lawyer running a large nonprofit organization, I deal a lot with politicians, with leaders within the punishment bureaucracy, with corporate people, with foundations and philanthropists, with a lot of journalists. Like, most of the elite people that I interact with, or let me just put it this way. Many of the elite people I interact with are not doing this in good faith. Like the leadership of the Democratic Party, the high-ranking people at the New York Times. I think that people like Herman Lopez and David Leonhardt at the New York Times are like very much not good faith actors. Or Anna Kasparian of Young Turks. These are people who like have been presented with and know like the actual evidence and have various incentives and personal and professional connections and relationships that lead them to, in my view, kind of intentionally trying to shape and misrepresent this kind of stuff. And I think there are a lot of amazing journalists. I mean, the whole book that I wrote is actually based on the incredible work of hundreds of journalists even from the New York Times or NBC or ABC or CNN, people who would send me stories and say, hey, my colleague just wrote this story. Could you comment on it? I want to share it in our Slack exchange. Or what do you think about this? Like, it seems wrong to me, you know? So like, there are many people within these institutions that get it or that are at least skeptical. But I think at a lot of the higher levels, these decisions are being made in a way that is at least knowingly misleading. But I don't think that's the most important aspect of all this. You know, like the fact of the matter is it's really important that all of us develop more critical comprehension skills and that we come together to, the whole last chapter of the book is all about ways that we could come together to address these problems. Because it's, you know, like the Bukele story you just put up, that to me is sort of like where this is all going. We are creating a society where we are kidnapping people off the street and essentially selling them to foreign countries with no due process of law whatsoever. And then it's not like they're being, and this is why I think it's so outlandish for the New York Times to call it a deportation. There weren't deportation proceedings.
Right.
And
it's a kidnapping.
When you deport somebody to another country, you usually deport them to live somewhere else. You don't deport them to an indefinite prison camp where they could be spend decades, you know, with no hope of getting out or be traded to some other country. You know, I mean, it makes no sense. And if the US government can, with no legal proceedings, just take anybody it wants, and now the Trump administration is talking about doing this to naturalized citizens or even citizens who've been convicted of crimes, just like all of these Venezuelans are supposed to be like convicted criminals at first, right? Which is not true. It can do it to anybody. And their official position is that once they send you across the border, even US citizens have no recourse. There's no court that can release you. There's nothing that can be done. If this is allowed to stand, this is the most consequential moment in US constitutional history in modern times. And the New York Times article about it is portraying this as some kind of feud between El Salvador and Venezuela. And it's like not providing any of the context about the illegal kidnappings, about the courts that tried to stop it by grounding the planes, the defiance of the Trump administration to the Supreme Court order, all of the stuff that is essential for understanding this constitutional crisis. The Times is just ignoring it and they're portraying it as like, oh, you know, the El Salvador leader is saying the Venezuelan government is authoritarian and should release these political prisoners. And the Venezuelan government is saying the US government shouldn't have done this to these people and send them to El Salvador. And it's like this, oh, well, who's right? You know, these two foreign, like, you know, kind of cartoonish leaders are feuding with each other. Whereas like the real story and the frame. So basically my point is the framing of the Times article is totally normalizing some of the most shocking and serious threats to our collective well-being in modern history.
And illegal, right? I mean, they're also, they're talking about things that are very illegal as if they are part of immigration due process.
I mean, the Supreme Court has already said that even under the Trump administration's invocation of this Alien and Enemies Act, which is going to be litigated in court, and like, it seems pretty clear that like, you can't invoke that act in these circumstances. Even under that, though, people would be entitled to some process,
right?
And so there's no even colorable argument that anything that's happening here is legal,
right?
And that is just totally lost in the New York Times coverage.
And you know, another thing that I wanted to point out related to the same story of immigration, deportation, really kidnapping. So there's obviously Rego Garcia, who is being held right now in El Salvador. This case has gotten a lot of attention. Kilmar Abrego Garcia. I'm not even going to repeat what he's being accused of because I don't actually want to repeat the unfounded propaganda. But what I thought was really interesting is that the MSNBC or NBC, Meet the Press and Fox News, because I do this show where we watch the Sunday morning news shows, both of those shows did the same thing where they showed a clip of a woman whose daughter was killed by someone undocumented. I'm going to show the NBC version of this instead of the Fox one, but literally they showed the same clip and they ask the same question. So this is Chris Van Hollen from Maryland who visited Garcia Abrego, and see how Kristen Welker of Meet the Press, NBC, responds to his discussion about having visited this person.
You know, the other thing that we witnessed at the White House this week, Patty Morin, the mother of Rachel Morin, who is a Maryland woman who was murdered by an undocumented immigrant, you're very familiar with this, was at the White House, and she did speak from the White House briefing room. I want to play you a little bit of what she had to say and get your reaction on the other side. Take a look.
To have a senator from Maryland who didn't even acknowledge or barely acknowledged my daughter and the brutal death that she endured, leaving her five children without a mother and now a grandbaby without a grandmother, so that he can use my taxpayer money to fly to El Salvador to bring back someone that's not even an American citizen. Why does that person have more right than I do, or my daughter?
And this, of course, relates to the use of anecdote, which is something that you write about in your book. You write about the selective curation of anecdote being an essential mechanism of propaganda. But can you talk about why it is that you have both NBC, it's not as shocking as Fox News, but why is NBC basically doing propaganda and PR for the Trump administration? And how could they possibly show this clip, which has absolutely nothing to do with this case?
It's unconscionable. It's disgusting. It's depraved because they know exactly what the Trump administration is using this for. And also, there's another point I want to make about this, which it's not just the selective curation of anecdote. I have a section in the book where I use examples mainly from NPR and New York Times and a few other, you know, outlets that are considered to be liberal, The Atlantic. Right. It's the way that the emotional suffering and you know, when you see someone who's lost a child,
so many
your heart goes out to them.
Of course.
I mean, nobody should suffer that ever. And nobody wants to watch somebody suffer that. It's horrific. And I got into this work because I want a world with less violence. And that's why I'm so passionate about these issues, because the policies we're pursuing, you know, if police prosecution and prisons made our society safer, we would have the safest society in the history of the world. We're spending more money on those things than anybody ever. Those things do not make us safer. That's why I do this work. I care about violence and harm and trauma. And what's going on here is somebody's grief and trauma is being weaponized to create a system where more people will lose their children, where more mothers will have a child die, be separated from them, not just in the United States, but globally. And that's what's so tragic here. And it's just so disgusting about NBC's weaponization of this. But I also want to say something like about NBC. You have a responsibility to not use this one right. person's grief to essentially randomly say that a different person unrelated to the case who happens to be the same race or ethnicity as that person should spend the rest of their life in a torture chamber in El Salvador's terrorism prison. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, how is that in any way connected to... And I do think you didn't want to bring up the facts underlying Kilmar Abrego yeah. Garcia's case, but I just want to say...
I meant the allegations, but please go ahead. Right. Whatever you present will be very thoughtful and well, thorough, yeah.
The allegations against him are... They stemmed from a single corrupt cop in Maryland who has been suspended and I believe... or let's just say an allegedly corrupt cop that the state's attorney put on a list of people that they wouldn't rely on. And the allegations stemmed from I believe he was like outside Home Depot years ago with people he didn't even know looking for work, and was arrested and never convicted of anything at all. And it's that little interaction. And the reason it relates here is the media is constantly printing the things that police say,
right,
without questioning whether they're true. And so many people's faces and mugshots and stories are in the news after like their arrest or something, and the facts that are alleged against them end up never being proven whatsoever. And this takes that sort of thing I talk about a little bit in the book about the media kind of weaponizing narratives of police. It takes it to like the very, very last logical step, which is that years later, somebody can be ripped away from their family and deported and sent to a torture chamber indefinitely because there's no laws. I mean, he's not there pursuant to any law. He could be detained as long as El Salvador. I mean, he could be detained for 50 years. And all of that is happening because on one day, a cop who has been found to have at least alleged other credibility violations or concerns by the state attorney, because that officer made some allegation in the police report about him that has never been proven in a court. And that's very scary.
Yeah. It's also scary. This is a different point. When people think that they're like experts in law, you have a lot of people being like, well, he's not a citizen, kind of shifting to the Mahmoud Khalil argument. He's not a citizen, so he doesn't have First Amendment protections. Like, people just pick up these talking points that are actually not based in fact, which is another phenomenon. So if we had a society that actually cared about keeping people safe, keeping people alive, what would this society be investing in? And what would they be covering? What stories would our media be covering?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite parts of the book is I sort of talk about the concept of what is news and what the news could look like. And I've been working with news outlets across the country to expand their connection to a wide range of other sources. Like, for example, the police spend billions of dollars in public relations, you know, like the Chicago police, when they killed Laquan McDonald, had 4 full-time PR officials. Now they have over 50. You know, the LA sheriff has over 42 full-time PR officials, according to the LA Times investigation, another 27 for the LAPD. I mean, NYPD has over 80. I mean, but the schools don't have, you know, and teachers unions and the school department, and people who are testing the water and the soil, people who are doing OSHA violations, child labor investigation, wage theft stuff, all of these entities that are learning really important information about our health, well-being, and safety don't have the public relations apparatus, right? And so they are not able to get those things into the news. And if the news were much more oriented toward the kinds of things that affect our health and well-being, so the things that kill the most people, the things that cause the most death and injury and illness, the things that affect people's health and well-being the most, it would be covering things like access to healthcare and the crimes of the powerful and wealthy and air pollution and water pollution and public corruption and tax evasion.
Worst landlord. You have that idea for a TV show called Worst Landlord,
yeah,
right? I mean, this week, or the worst landlord of the week, or
yeah,
something.
The news could station a reporter in housing court and just have a bad landlord of the week or bad landlord of the day segment. Right. And people would watch that, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, there was just a fire in New York City that killed people in a place where the landlord didn't have working smoke detectors. And that is a horrific tragedy. But that happens all over the country, in every single city, every single day. There are things like that happening. And the news media is not covering it with the same level of urgency for a variety of reasons. And you can have all kinds of comebacks and arguments, counterarguments, and I address a lot of them in the book. But the fact remains that the things that we are made to be afraid of and the solutions that we have to those things are actually not correlated with the empirical evidence of the kinds of things that are harming our health, well-being, and safety and costing us our lives. And that distortion, that gap is propaganda. And that gap is responsible for many people in our society not treating some of the most urgent issues of our time with the same level of urgency that they treat shoplifting. And that is a real scandal.
Yeah, that is a scandal. And it is an interesting thought experiment to think about what the news would look like if people's health, safety, not being killed were actually the priorities. You also bring something up that I think is really important, because this is another argument that we hear a lot from people. Again, sometimes it's cynical. Sometimes I think people really think it's true. You write, professional class news consumers regularly accuse any skeptic of the moral panic du jour of being an elitist who is out of touch with the most marginalized communities. Can you talk about this narrative and how it functions and what the reality is?
Yeah. So one of the quick, very facile retorts is like, well, you're minimizing all this violence, and the problem with you is that you don't care about poor people, or you don't care about Black people, or you don't care about the most marginalized communities in our country, because those are the communities that are the most victimized by crime. So first of all, it's an odd criticism, because most of the people that are leveling it at me are like elite journalists and pundits,
right,
who have not devoted their lives to trying to reduce violence and harm in marginalized communities. But I don't actually think we should focus on like who is making their critique, or I mean it's hypocritical and, you know, quite funny.
Right.
But there are a lot of like otherwise very intelligent and good journalists, like Lee Fong does this a lot. Glenn Greenwald, even, I think maybe influenced by Lee Fong, has done some really weird stuff. Someone who otherwise seems quite capable of very rigorous and rational and impressive argumentation. And even, you know, he has old books that go into some of these issues, you know? And I talk about this Greenwald and Fong, particularly weird Greenwald and Fong interview in the book, because it's a good representation of this kind of argument. Their way of handling it is very bizarre. It's like to attack the person making the argument rather than deal with the substance of the point, which is that if you care about violence and harm, especially if you care about violence and harm in these communities, you want to follow the evidence. You want to invest in things that actually increases people's life expectancy, that actually reduces the likelihood that they're going to be subjected to violence and trauma and harm. And it's one of the things that makes it so frustrating and painful to argue with a lot of journalists about this, is there's this background assumption that the only way you can express care for violence and harm is by investing in bureaucrats with guns, and by investing billions of dollars in Palantir and all of these other companies that are building these incredibly Orwellian surveillance networks. And most people just have no clue what police budgets are being spent on. And I believe if they had a better understanding of that, then they would be shocked and horrified. And so I have actually in the book a really great list of questions and follow-up questions and ideas for things you could ask local officials, local police chiefs, local prosecutors, local journalists, local elected officials. These are also tools that local journalists and local elected officials can use when talking to police, trying to tease out some of the information. Because the things that the police and the prosecution system and prisons are investing in are like scientifically shown to increase crime and not reduce overall levels of violence. And it's maddening that people who have devoted their lives to this, like many of my colleagues who are the victims of and survivors of violence and incredible harm and trauma and crime, you know, all of us have been, who I know, who I work closely with, have survived various crimes, you know, and to suggest that we don't care about safety because we're not willing to adopt the line that the police should hire a new videographer or 10 new public relations officials or sign a surveillance contract with, foreign companies that also provide the same technology to repressive right-wing regimes all over the world. To suggest that we don't care is really profoundly troubling and disappointing. And many of the mainstream news's sort of finest stars, you know, are engaging in this kind of thing all the time. This is one of the biggest retorts I get privately from New York Times reporters, for example. They say things like, well, you know, my goal is to tell the stories of the voiceless, and my role is to make sure our society knows the violence that these communities are plagued by. And it's like totally not responsive to the debate we're having, which is like, okay, yes, but like, should you be pointing people toward police as a solution to that? You know, it's total non sequitur.
Right. Yeah. And it's also presenting, I mean, it's like people who are harmed as like a monolith that have one opinion or that can be like represented by one person's story and one person's, you know, because people always like find one person who will say something that challenges the notion that decarceral prosecution is the way to go. Like that's better. And then they find one person who's been a victim of something or who is from a marginalized community and they'll say how bad that is. And then they point to that person and now they're speaking for all the marginalized people.
Yeah. I mean, I use another example that I just find I have to laugh at, you know, in there was an act that was about to, that was passed in California's legislature and Governor Gavin Newsom, you know, one of the most clownish figures in modern American society, in my opinion, was considering whether to veto this thing called the Mandela Act, named after Nelson Mandela, about limiting long-term solitary confinement in California. And these like local progressive, you know, or objective mainstream, you know, news outlets in California went and found like one person who had been in solitary confinement who was of the opinion that solitary confinement was necessary and good. And completely excluded the thousands of people and families who had organized. It's no small thing to mobilize enough people to organize to pass a law in California, like the sixth largest economy in the world. The legislature is very busy, right? And they passed this law and somehow the news didn't see fit to interview any of those people who wanted this law. And they found the one person. And I think a key point I make in the book is that argument would be a lot less powerful coming from the prison guards or the right wing, you know, but it's much more powerful if you can find the one person, you know, who's been in solitary confinement. And that is extremely effective and really, in my opinion, insidious propaganda.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the Democrats' weaponization of identity politics. Like when Hillary Clinton was like, well, breaking up the banks and racism, no. I mean, that kind of, obviously, that's not pointing to one example, but they would point to one example of one person to make that kind of reactionary argument dressed up as an identity politics, lived experience argument. So only because you mentioned Gavin Newsom, and I know how much you love him, and, you know, this is someone who he issued like a $50,000 award to find someone on the run who had murdered a police officer. Wanted to know your response to something that he said in response to Chris Van Hollen of Maryland going to visit Abrego Garcia.
Governor Gavin Newsom of California calling Mr. Abrego Garcia's case, quote, the distraction of the day. He argues Democrats are playing right into the hands of President Trump, an issue he wants to be focused on. How do you respond to Governor Newsom?
So I'm asking you how you respond.
I mean, I think that what is there really to say about this? I mean, this is somebody who responded to the fake shoplifting wave epidemic by showering hundreds of millions of dollars more on the punishment bureaucracy, contrary to all of the evidence, talking about distractions. But I think the key point here is, I don't think anybody who really understands like the importance of some of the basic principles like a due process can possibly think of this as a distraction. We have a situation here where somebody was kidnapped from the street and sent to another country's torture chamber prison with no process whatsoever. And then the government not only is defying court orders, but is taking the position that it is powerless to bring him back. And that's bone chilling. That, if that is allowed, all else follows. Anything is possible. There are no rules. The only rule is might versus right, right? The only rule is who has more power. It's a very ugly world that it portends. And anybody who doesn't see that is either themselves trying to distract people or is very ignorant about like the importance of basic protections to the kind of society that we all want to have. Now, to his credit, I have seen later quotes of Newsom kind of sounding more concerned about all this stuff. So I mean, Newsom may very well have said other things since then. I don't know. But to call that a distraction is like very troubling and problematic.
Yeah. And I think it's another example of this real problem, which is that Democrats don't know how to create affirmative framing around things. So all they can do when it comes to immigration and crime narratives is kind of tack right, be Republican light. And then they wind up not satisfying the people who are on the right, who prefer the more draconian, sadistic policies of the Republicans, but they also don't motivate the base. And they also happen to not do the right, the correct, the good thing. So next time you're on, we can spitball some ideas about how to get these ideas through to them.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you for coming on. It's a great book, Copaganda. And it's really, I have to say, like, it's a very enjoyable book. I'm not going to lie. Like, when I got in the mail, I was like, oh, this is going to be really interesting. I'm going to have to set aside a lot of time to read it. And it'll be edifying. And it is all those things, but it's actually like a surprisingly accessible and enjoyable book. And I know that's can be really hard for lawyers. So I want to congratulate and thank
you. Well, my grandmother, who is 93, has called it the most enjoyable book ever written by one of her grandchildren. So I praise. I also want to note one other thing, which is that all of the royalties are donated to charity. They're all donated to an amazing organization in Los Angeles that works with unhoused people called the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition. And also, we have set up a fund through donations, which can get free copies of the book to any teacher who wants to give them to their students and anybody in prison. So wow. With my last book, Usual Cruelty, we sent thousands and thousands of free copies of the book into prisons and into schools. So people should reach out if they are interested in that, if they're a teacher or if they're someone who works for a prison book program or something like that. And also like, just get the book. You're supporting a great cause. I think it's a great read. It has lots of, I guarantee you there's stuff in there that like will be new.
Yeah.
And stuff that I had no clue about before I started researching the book.
Yeah. And I'll just add that it is my favorite book by someone who's not my grandson.
Well, that's even higher praise.
I know. It's really good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alec, and definitely come back. And thank you for all the work that you do. And everyone should definitely follow Alec and purchase that book. And we'll put all the links to your Twitter and your organization website.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. Have a great night. Okay, that was great. And we are going to go out by just honoring someone who we lost. And by the way, that book is amazing. Really do read it. It's a great read. Obviously, people know that Pope Francis died recently. He was from Argentina, so he was the first Latin American pope. He was very progressive on a lot of issues, and he, of course, actually spoke about Gaza and Palestine. He did die shortly after speaking with J.D. Vance, and I don't know if that's if there's, you know, there's causation and there's correlation. So far, we just have correlation. But I did want to play his last address, his last public address that he gave. Let's take a listen. And the tweet says, Pope Francis used his last public address to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Even as he was hospitalized, he maintained his commitment to check in on a daily basis with priests and parishioners at the Holy Family Catholic Church in Gaza City. Rest in peace. So let's listen to what he had to say.
I continue to receive very serious and painful news from Gaza. Unarmed civilians are subjected to bombings and shootings. And this even happened inside the parish complex of the Holy Family, where there are no terrorists, but families, children, sick and disabled people, nuns. Some say it's terrorism, it's war. Yes, it's war, it's terrorism. This is why scripture states that God makes wars cease. He breaks bows and breaks spears. Let us pray to the Lord for peace.
So it's too bad that he didn't live longer because he was probably one of the best popes we'll have in a long time. So Wyatt Reed tweeted this out. Israel just deleted their tribute to Pope Francis after getting ratioed by reminders that he viewed them as terrorists and loved Palestinians. And so you can see, here it is. So Pope Francis, this is like one of the responses. Pope Francis supported Palestine until his last breath. And that was in response to Israel saying, rest in peace, Pope Francis. May his memory be a blessing. Okay, let's see what else they pointed out. And then this post has been deleted. Right underneath there, you can see this isn't war anymore. This is terrorism. Post Francis on your genocidal war in Gaza. So yeah, that's I guess that's one way of dealing with being ratioed on Twitter. But yeah, again, I'm not Catholic, but I'm not Christian. But I do think that he's much closer to Jesus than other popes that we've seen and most members of the clergy, if I do say so myself. Thank you so much for watching. Make sure you go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow to support the show because we could not do the show without you. You will be able to later this week get the rest of that Oliver Stone, Jim DeEugenio interview. And there's also a forthcoming Jim interview about who killed Martin Luther King. Bucky, you want to come on stage? Let me see if I can get Bucky. Buck, come here. I really am going to have to change his bow tie because it's getting embarrassing. Like people are seeing him in the same bow tie again and again. So we'll get him on. Look how cute he is. Anyway, he's saying hi. But thank you guys again so much for watching. Thank you for the research, Nate. Thank you for the editing, the podcast, Andrew. Thank you, Brad, for everything. Thank you, Phantom Esfanta, for the clips. And I will see you guys next week. Bye, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks, and my upcoming documentary and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.